The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at cooperadio.org.
On today's show, we have back on our program Jen St. Denis. She's with the Tyee.ca and is investigating stories throughout the downtown East Side. Welcome back to The Pulse, Jen. It's always great to have you with us.
Hi, David. It's nice to be back.
Yeah. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
I'm hoping that it's a gorgeous week ahead. Of course, warmer weather means that a little more comfort for people sleeping or spending their time out on the streets, too.
The one thing about this, the really clear weather, is that it does tend to get colder. So, that is something I always think when it's like nice and sunny, you always wonder, oh, but it might get cold.
Over the weekend, the city activated its emergency heat shelters. One of the things, of course, that helps people stay warm when they're on the street, either sleeping or vending or just being out and about, is, their possessions, their blankets, sleeping bags, various items that they, you know, at great expense and effort, carry around with them. I wanted to talk about a piece that you wrote for the Tyee about those possessions, because for a long time we've seen these city trucks, often accompanied by police, going and grabbing people's tents and possessions and things and loading them up. And it's raised concerns. So you looked into this as an investigative journalist, thankfully, and found some stuff out.
Yeah. So I've written a couple stories about this because I kept on hearing these concerns about this happening. Both from advocates, people like Sarah Blythe, who runs the overdose prevention site, and also from people who are homeless, that it just happens to them constantly, that they'll be out on the street, and often usually on Hastings Street, this is where it happens, and they'll have their stuff out because that's where their home is. They live on Hastings Street. And every morning this happens where the city crews accompanied by police come, and you know, the city always says, oh, we don't throw out personal possessions and we give people time to, you know, pack up their stuff. But what the people who are unhoused, their experience is that it's sort of indiscriminate and that everything goes into the garbage trucks and they end up losing their tents, you know, all of their clothing, for instance, and then they have to replace it again and again.
What kind of stuff are they taking and what are they doing with the stuff?
Yeah, so the first person I talked to was this guy called Bill, and he had been camping with his tent, not on Hastings, but just sort of like a few blocks away. And so his tent got taken one day and it was his only shelter. And then the next day it was just a really, really rainy week in November, just rainstorms constantly. And he just had no shelter the next night and was completely soaking wet. I've heard of such a wide variety of things being taken. Sometimes people are artists on the street and they're making art and they're selling it. So that's important to their livelihood, especially when they're homeless.
And that's such a great part of our neighborhood, like the carvers and painters that are contributing so much.
I've heard of art and art supplies being taken. I've heard of, you know, so, well, one of the stories that I wrote was about somebody's walker being taken. And that was pretty shocking. So I did write a whole story about that.
Like their mobility aid, like they needed it to walk.
His mobility aid. Yeah, he's in a wheelchair because he has cellulitis. He has this bacterial infection in his legs that's quite common for people who are homeless. And he's actually missing a toe, part of a toe, I think, and he just can't walk very well. So he uses a wheelchair and he has a walker. And so apparently this one morning last October, he and his girlfriend were sleeping on Hastings, and yeah, his walker got scooped up and his wheelchair. And then they were able to replace the wheelchair, but they still weren't able to replace the walker.
Wait, they had to replace the wheelchair? They didn't just get the original one back?
No, because apparently it all just goes into the garbage.
They took a guy's wheelchair and walker.
Yes. And I did some work to verify this. I heard this from this man called Dave Dixon, who is a well-known former police officer who worked in the downtown East Side for 30 years.
Very well-beloved police constable, long time, and very involved in actually speaking out against his own department around missing women when the department didn't want to believe it.
Yes. So he left the VPD a while ago, over a decade ago, but he still works in the neighborhood because he loves the neighborhood so much. He still works there as an outreach worker. And he was the one who told me about this business about the walker being taken, because this group of people, he knows them very, very well. He talks to them every single day. They're a group of Indigenous people who are kind of a street family. And so he knows all of them. He's known them. Some of them he's known since they were kids, actually, because he's been in the neighborhood for so long.
Preston and Destiny, the ones who lost the walker allegedly and Cherub, they're well known. Like I recognize them.
Dave said to me, you know, I totally believe this happened to them. He wrote it down in his logbook. I went and talked to Preston and Destiny. They told me the same story. It was exactly matched up. So I thought it was a very credible story. The city says that the city workers don't remember taking a walker, but they said it might have been scooped up if it was like inside a tent or something. But the long shot is that the Preston needs a walker and it was taken, and he still doesn't have a walker today because this happened to him and he's homeless. He doesn't have a home. He's on the street in a wheelchair without a walker. You're not allowed to have a tent on the sidewalk. And you can understand why the city has that rule, because the sidewalks are for walking, for getting around the neighborhood. And Hastings Street always has this real, you know, push and pull between people who are using the street to live on. They have to live on the street because places like Oppenheimer Park are totally closed and or other places are maybe not as welcoming. But then there's also like businesses, you know, there's a lot of housing on Hastings, like SRO buildings and other apartment buildings that they need to be able to get in and out of the building. And so sometimes people are camping out outside of entrances and making it hard to get into them. So there is a reason for the city to try to keep the sidewalk somewhat clear. And people are supposed to move their stuff, by 9 o'clock a.m. So that's kind of the general rule. But what happens is that there's just always these tensions and confrontations with the city workers accompanied by police, you know, trying to get people to pack up. And the people are packing up all their stuff. So sometimes it takes a long time. And there's people get upset. People get angry because they're sort of being hassled to do this. So it's just this real point of conflict on the street.
You mentioned Oppenheimer Park. That space being gone. So it's kind of more pressure on people to be on more visible streets like Hastings than used to be the case. What's going on with parks? I know you've kind of talked to a lot of people who are just really saying it's not just Oppenheimer, but green space in general is just more and more inaccessible in the neighborhood during COVID.
Yeah. So Oppenheimer, you know, we all know that on Oppenheimer Park, there was a tent city there for 2 years and it got removed in the spring. So in May 2020, it got removed with the help of the province, who had bought like some hotels and other properties to move people into them. But after they closed the camp, they fenced off the entire park. And it's still 10 months later, it's still fenced off. So you can't use it at all. And there hasn't been a lot of communication to the neighborhood about what's going on with that and when it's going to be open and why it's still closed and what the plan is when it does open, so that it doesn't get completely taken over by tents again and people can't use it as a park. Like, how are they going to kind of make sure that park is a usable park space, which is so needed during COVID-19 especially. But there's another conflict with another park in the neighborhood, with Pigeon Park, which we know is such an important park to people. A lot of people use it kind of as their living room because they live in these tiny rooms and they don't have anywhere else to gather, especially during COVID. And I found out that for 2 years, a developer has been using half of the park to park its construction equipment. So that park as well is kind of, partly out of commission as well. And those two parks are really important to the downtown Eastside neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, especially during COVID, because we're not supposed to be having visitors. And many people, in fact, have been having trouble having visitors, as should be their right in their houses. So being outdoors is the safest place to be during a pandemic.
Yeah, and there's been other places too, like a lot of drop-in spaces also are reduced capacity. There's just a lot of pressure on people when it comes to how they're going to socialize, you know, also just like getting outside for a walk or to do any of these activities. Like, you know, I know a lot of vending goes on in Pigeon Park. So activities like that too, that are kind of like survival for people to make a little bit of extra money to supplement their incomes. Like, there's a lot of uses for these spaces. So it is, you know, kind of impacting the neighborhood that two of these main parks are partially closed.
What is going to happen with those? Are we going to hopefully see something open up or more spaces available? Or is there any sign of an end for Oppenheimer, for instance?
The park board says they will have a plan soon, but I don't actually know what the timeline is. And with Pigeon Park, it's kind of the same thing. The developer is supposed to wrap up the work this spring. So I guess those parks will open at some point. But I think what the advocates I talked to, I talked to Sarah Blythe and Christopher Livingstone and Karen Ward, these three advocates in the neighborhood, about this whole situation. And they were like, you know, at the very least, they should be consulting with the neighborhood or like putting up some sort of notice board, like letting people know like what is the plan. Because the situation right now is just, oh, well, it's closed until further notice. And Oppenheimer is like an enormous park. It takes up an entire city block. And it's just been closed for basically the entire pandemic at a time when other city parks have been so important and so well used during the pandemic.
That, of course, brings us to a topic that I think you've written about most recently. And last week, there was a standoff at Strathcona Tent City, which, of course, is the successor to Oppenheimer Park Encampment. And to its after that, the Crab Park, and then they moved to Strathcona. We've covered this a lot. Police moved in significant numbers last week, and it turned out that they were looking for a suspect in the murder of this woman, senior woman in Mount Pleasant. Tell us about what happened and what we know about this incident. Very, very troubling.
It's a very disturbing incident. So the incident that the police were ended up, turns out that they were investigating, was this violent home invasion that happened about a week ago in near Queen Elizabeth Park. And it was these two men dressed as police officers, and they were able to get inside this woman's home. She's 78 years old, and she was badly injured during the incident, and she later died. So then it became a homicide investigation.
Oh, it's really terrible.
It's shocking and very sad. In the course of investigating that, police showed up at Oppenheimer, or sorry, they showed up at Strathcona Park, I think a little after midnight on Tuesday of last week. And so I wasn't there. I didn't witness this myself, but I did see a lot of video. And I talked to Chrissy Brett, one of the camp organizers. And so they were confused about why police were there, and they were challenging their ability to, like, their presence to be there, like whether it was legitimate, is what I gather from the video.
Now, the police said that they were confronted by what sounds like an unruly mob, and they had to use quote unquote crowd control techniques to, you know, stop this. From the tenter's perspective, talking to Chrissy, they were, you know, drumming and singing as Indigenous youth, and it was the kind of response they'd probably been preparing if the tent city was going to be broken up one day.
Yeah, you're right. You're probably right. That is probably what they thought was happening, or they were concerned about that as well. They were drumming and they were singing, but they were also, there's a lot of verbal altercations between the two groups. So the people protest, you know, the tent city supporters were yelling a lot of obscenities at the police. The police were kind of one of the police officers, it seemed like, was kind of arguing back to them. So, I mean, it never got, from what I saw in the video, it never got violent. The police were heavily armed, but as far as I could see, they were always pointing their guns towards the ground. But it was a pretty fraught situation.
Did they ever explain why they were there? Like, did they ever say, we're here as part of a separate homicide investigation and not here to kick you out or arrest you?
Yeah, they said they were executing a search warrant. And they explained they were searching a trailer, and I think they were searching one of the tents. Mm-hmm. So they kept explaining to that. People in the crowd kept saying that they wanted to see the search warrant, and the police kept explaining that they can't show the search warrant because there's a privacy rule that prevents them from showing the search warrant to anyone who's not the person being searched.
So in the end, the police arrested two people that day. One of them was near Main and Terminal in a trailer, and the other one was
near the park. Yeah, just near the park.
And the guy's name was Sandy Parisian. And in fact, he was referred to himself as the mayor of the Oppenheimer Park Tent City just a year earlier. He's one of the suspects, has not been convicted yet, but he was arrested in that raid. That was the search warrant that they were apparently looking for in the park.
Yeah, that's right.
And obviously, this is some of the park's opponents have jumped on this. For instance, Safer Vancouver, Step Up Vancouver, Westside homeowners kind of group that's opposed the park, has said that the park has taken a darker turn. Thankfully, police acted quickly to address the public safety threat, and to say that the park has become a haven for violent predators seeking refuge in illegal encampments, and blaming it on the defund the police movement. What do you think about that?
So I didn't see those comments, but it seems like pretty standard stuff coming from that particular group, who are very much about law and order and they're worried about crime. The sentiment is being argued a bit, like maybe not the defund the police part, but the sentiment about the concern about criminal activity happening in the tent city, and also the tent city shielding people who have been involved in criminal activity. That concern is shared by at least two counselors. I talked to Pete Councillor Pete Fry, and I talked to Councillor Rebecca Bly, and they were very shaken by the whole incident, because when Fry, Bly, and Lisa Dominato, another councillor, had gone to the park that afternoon after the raid had happened to meet with media, with a global news crew, and just to kind of do some interviews. And they were standing on the very edge of the park, and they were confronted by a few people from the camp who were actually ordered them to leave. And they said, you know, we weren't even in the park. We were standing right at the edge. And they were just telling us that we had no business being there and had to leave. And they're like, you know, this is a public city park. Hmm. So they were very much saying that this shows to them that the park needs to be shut down, that there's just too much criminal activity going on there, you know, just really questioning whether it was really a camp to help people who are homeless, or whether it was a camp that had a little bit more, you know, sinister things going on inside of it.
Now, the city had just delivered showers and washrooms to the park, but we still haven't seen a significant presence of any kind of counseling, social work, housing providers there that I've seen anytime I've been. Is there any movement happening other than the showers and tents being delivered?
Well, there's been PHS outreach workers have been there the entire time. So I'm not really sure whether there was like social workers and trauma workers requested by the camp. But no, I haven't heard of that.
And what about housing? Because if that's what the park wants.
Housing is a slow moving thing. Very slow moving. It's when you can contrast it to what they did with Oppenheimer Park, where the province went in at great expense, bought a hotel like right away. And that is part of what pushed up the price of that Howard Johnson hotel so much. I think it was like some insane amount of money, $500 million or something for that hotel. That happened really, really quickly in the spring, and the camp was decamped really quickly. But with Strathcona, it's been a lot slower process. It's just been this kind of gradual thing. And David Eby has promised that the minister who's in responsible for housing, he's promised that housing will be found for everybody by the end of April. But now these two councillors, Rebecca Bly and Pete Fry, are saying, you know, that seems like too long now, in light of this most recent situation. That seems like too long, and that they're worried that it's just become too unsafe and it needs to be decamped right away.
So it sounds like the city is not going. It sounds like the city is not going for the rapidly built tiny homes that architects and planners had proposed that could have been erected in a month. They're not doing that anymore.
Oh yeah, no. We at the Tidy had kind of explored that idea a lot, and it had been kind of proposed as one of the things they might want to think about. I think they're coming back with staff went away to study it, and they're maybe coming back with something like this summer or something. So that's not something that's really in the cards.
Yeah, I mean, it just sounds like a lack of imagination and ambition confronted even with a situation that's so volatile and obviously getting worse in many ways. I mean, I don't think anyone can say that, you know, alleged murderer being in that camp is a sign of, you know, this is a positive long-term solution to homelessness. Like I don't, and all the chop shops that are there.
You know, there were very disturbing incidents that happened at Oppenheimer Park as well.
In fact, the police had just had this manhunt looking for the suspects in that, and have repeatedly been like, going through the process of finding those people responsible for that violent attack in Oppenheimer.
They keep on running away, apparently. And what we're talking about at Oppenheimer Park is this really terrible incident that happened where a woman was held for hours and hours in a tent and assaulted repeatedly. So terrible things have happened at these tent cities. Now, the camp supporters always say to me, well, terrible things also happen in SROs in the downtown east side.
Which is totally true.
But terrible things are also happening in the tent cities. So it's terrible. None of it should be happening. I think what is really interesting about what this incident shows, though, and how the kind of language that people were using when they were telling the police, to leave. Like, they were outright ordering police to get out of the tent city. They outright ordered city councilors away from the park. So the question about, and talking about like unceded, this is unceded land, you know, this is indigenous territory. So my question is just like, what does that really mean? And who gets to decide that? And practically, how does that work on the ground? Like, are you really saying that police don't have any authority in the park? Is that really what you're saying? And what is the structure that you want in that case?
To me, it seems symptomatic of a really serious breakdown of trust with the police that goes beyond just a few campers.
Yeah. And we were talking earlier about, you know, the walker being taken by city workers who are always accompanied by police. people's trust in the police in the downtown east side is, I think, at a very, very low point. And it's a problem. It's a huge problem. And I was talking about Dave Dixon, the retired police officer. He agrees with me. He says it's terrible right now. And he's really worried that it's actually putting police officers in danger, because people are so angry at the police right now that he's worried that, you know, violence happens because people are just so angry and so distrustful of police. And I think it's a real problem when, you know, it comes to them being able to investigate actual crimes that I know people in the downtown east side community desperately want resolved.
Now, I was just about to ask you about your meeting with Dave Dixon when you talked to him, because I think he's such a respected figure in the neighborhood that kind of is a reminder that the police can build trust. Like, people, broadly speaking, and everyone I've talked to, still really respects Dave Dixon, and he continues to maintain relationships years after he's off the force, taking people for coffees and lunches and just showing some respect. Does he have any suggestions for what needs to be done to, like, actually improve trust with the police and actually stop some of these, you know, more egregious abuses of people's rights that we've seen pop up time to time?
Yeah, I mean, I think he just, I'm not sure if Dave really expressed to me any, like, concrete things that police could do, but he just talked about how he used to run his job and that he would really, really, really work hard to create relationships with people. He did a lot of work with youth in the downtown east side and Strathcona area. He really worked hard to try to kind of keep them out of trouble, to kind of forge those relationships early and then keep going back. And I just don't see that happening today. I see, you know, and he said he saw a shocking incident. He saw a police officer, like, punch somebody who hadn't answered him quickly enough when he asked this guy, where are you going, and stop? And he said, I was shocked to see that. And so, and he said to me, you know, there are police officers doing good work in the downtown east side, but that work is being undermined by these other officers who just aren't behaving properly. So, I mean, I would suggest that I think there really needs to be some sort of reassessment of how policing is happening in the downtown east side, what is going on, how police can build trust with people, because it is a neighborhood where terrible crime happens, and it is a neighborhood where people are victimized, and people do want to see justice happen, but a lot of things just do not go reported at all because people have such terrible relationships with the police.
Hmm. If anything, perhaps former Constable Dixon's best advice would be just that, to look at him. You know, what did he do right? What have the officers who have built trust and slowly built relationships done right? And maybe it's actually in the practice, not like some ambitious program. Like, you don't need to have more training programs in how not to punch people when they don't answer quickly enough, for instance. It's more about empathy.
Yeah, and I hear complaints about the way that police, you know, large numbers of police, for instance, will kind of walk down Hastings Street at night, sort of in the early evening, and just sort of, people complain about police being rude to them for no reason, like just little things like that. And I hear those things, you know, and I just hear them all the time. And I just think, why is this happening? Like, it's, it seems like some sort of reset is needed at this point.
Yeah. You know, the times that I've seen police getting respect and politeness from folks, at least along Hastings and the, like, you know, the vendors area around the market there, is when I've seen police just kind of just go up and say hi to people, and not there to investigate something negative. Like, I think when your only interaction with the community is seen as an attack and always responding or reacting, that you're going to get that reaction back.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, it is really interesting. I had coffee with Dave Dixon a couple times, and then we would go out and walk around a little bit. It was really interesting seeing how he would interact with people, and people were very comfortable talking with him. I was just struck by it, because I was like, well, this is really different than some of the other interactions I've witnessed. So
probably the lack of uniform helps, though.
For sure. He's in a different role right now, completely different role as an outreach worker.
But yeah, thank you for reminding us of the work that he did too and continues to do. It's great to have kind of some reminders of positive things happening. And I guess, is there anything else you're looking at these days that we should keep an eye out for?
Oh, well, David, you know, I'm always looking into things, but I will have some stories coming out soon, sort of centering around housing and how some certain housing is being run. So that's what I'm working on right now. And you guys can look for my stuff in the tie.ca.
And if people need to reach you or think they have a story that needs to be investigated, how can they find you?
You know what? Get on Facebook and they can use Messenger to message me, and they can do that even if I'm not their friend on Facebook. So that's how a lot of people get in touch with me. My Twitter is @JenSaintDen.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jen. And I hope you enjoyed the sun this week. Look forward to your next story.
You too, David.
Bye-bye. And that was Jen St. Denis, a Downtown Eastside reporter for thetie.ca. Her latest investigation is called Who Controls Strathcona Park? Police and Councillors Clash with Tent City Residents, from just on Friday. And her beat is actually funded by the same funding pool that we are at The Pulse on CFRO. That's the Local Journalism Initiative, funded by Heritage Canada.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.